Hello and welcome to the Global Capital Podcast. I'm Ralph Sinclair and I'm the London Bureau Chief at Global Capital.
And I'm John Hay, Corporates, Markets and Sustainability Editor.
This week we're joined by our brand new columnist, Craig Coben, who'll be talking to us about the perils that can face some banks when issuance volumes pick up in the capital markets.
Yes, it's a paradoxical idea, but I'm sure one that will be recognised across the street. Craig, as I'm sure many people know, was Global Head of Equity Capital Markets at Bank of America Merrill Lynch, and before that, Head of European Equity Capital Markets at Deutsche Bank. So he's had a long career in the city, also worked in Asia, and before that, even as a lawyer. So he's an extremely experienced capital markets banker, and we're delighted to have him as a new columnist. And, you know, people who had anything to do with ECM know that Craig is also funny and entertaining and will be a fund of new ideas.
Yeah, and that really does come through in his writing, which is quite superb. We'll also be talking to him about what else he'll be writing for us in the future. And that includes our new Agony Aunt column called New Issues, which is your chance to write in to Craig and pose your professional dilemmas. Perhaps you were passed over for promotion. Perhaps you just can't stand your boss. Perhaps you can't stand your clients. Perhaps you can't stand any of it any longer. But whatever dilemma is eating you from the inside, Craig will no doubt have sound words of advice based on his many years of experience at the most senior levels in capital markets.
So to write to the capital markets new agony uncle, just email agony@globalcapital.com, and we will treat this in complete confidence, but we'd be delighted to hear of any teasing difficulties or problems that you'd like Craig to think about.
First, John, an update on last week's piece about multilateral development bank capital. Now, we don't often feature the same topic in successive weeks, but this is one of those stories that's picking up speed, and the effects of which really could be life-changing for some of the world's most vulnerable people. Perhaps you could start by giving us a quick recap on why MDB capital is such a big topic at the moment.
Yeah, so essentially the shareholders of multilateral development banks, which are national governments, are trying to get more development finance benefit out of the capital they've given them, and trying to see whether these very conservatively managed organisations, which are most of the large ones are AAA rated, they're very secure and risk averse, whether they can basically do a bit more. Probably while still retaining their AAA ratings. I think that's definitely the intention of the MDBs themselves, and I think pretty much everybody agrees now that that should be the case. But whether they can increase their activity.
Okay, and so last week the MDBs explained the situation with their callable capital. That's the capital that is promised to them by their shareholders, but which hasn't been paid in. And is therefore sort of a fairly complicated thing to assess in terms of judging then what effect it can have on what they can lend. But now they're talking about enhanced callable capital. What's that?
Yeah, so the ironic thing is that although the shareholders want the MDBs to do more with their capital, they've given them very little of it. And at the World Bank, for example, it's only ever been given $22 billion of paid-in capital. It's got $296 billion of callable capital. Now, everybody knows that this callable capital can be used in extreme circumstances by the World Bank to make sure it can meet its obligations, which is basically disbursing loans that it's already promised and repaying its debt. So it's a sort of ultimate backstop. But nobody knows much more about it or you know, whether we can get any more benefit out of it. It's not counted as capital and therefore not included in their leverage ratio. And so if they do $5 of loans for every dollar of capital, the callable capital isn't used. So that is what all these five MDBs published reports about 10 days ago, saying, you know, this is what we understand callable capital to be.
OK, and then so how's that evolved then this week? What's this enhanced callable capital?
Yeah.
That sounds like an extra wrinkle.
Right. So there's a few stages before we get to that. But basically, the thing is that having provided more clarity on callable capital is a good thing. And this, it is hoped, will go into a sort of virtuous circle where the rating agencies have more knowledge about what callable capital is. and understand its benefits better, that they will therefore perhaps change the way they see it, either qualitatively or perhaps even quantitatively, including it differently in their rating models. And this in turn will give the MDBs confidence to put it into their capital adequacy models and, you know, therefore leverage it up a bit. Now, and the shareholders are sort of want this to happen. And they also have a role because they are, you know, the providers of the callable capital. They are the ultimate governors and controllers of the banks. The problem has been that because they're international organizations, if the governors and the shareholders are going to do anything, it has to be through consensus. And also, they're not specialists. These are governments that have their own political priorities. They think about the MDBs sometimes, but it's not top of mind for them. So the people best informed about the MDBs are the banks themselves. Now, because of all this, making callable capital more useful is quite difficult. And there's a limit, perhaps, to how far we can go. Because if everybody's actually understood what it is correctly, and by and large they have, there's a limit to how much extra rating benefit, how much extra leverage you're going to be able to put on it. Fundamentally, it is an obligation on the shareholders that they will pay in some hard to imagine future, if ever needed. So the idea of enhanced callable capital is, well, can we do something to actually alter the instrument itself and make it better?
And of course, a key player in all of this is the major credit rating agencies who assign the AAA credit ratings to the MDBs, which they're so keen to keep hold of to facilitate their cheap borrowing and lending. And their response to the publications last week of the explanations by Callable Capital was, I mean, I might be oversimplifying here, John, and I'm sure you'll correct me, but rather akin to sort of being shown an artwork by a small child, and you know the response is, well, how lovely. Doesn't really change our view. And so I guess that's why the MDBs are now coming up with these enhanced schemes. Is that right?
Well, yes. I mean, they've been everything in this whole field goes slowly. Right. Everything takes a long time. It's all complicated. You're dealing with international organizations, international agreements and so on. So nothing happens fast. The work on enhanced callable capital has been going on for some months, if not longer. So it's not because of the way the rating agencies have reacted to the MDB reports. You're right about the their reaction. Essentially, they said, this is interesting. You know, thank you for this. It does help us understand callable capital better. But it's probably not going to fundamentally change our view of how much leverage you can put on it. So, yes, you know, there might be a little bit of extra rating headroom to be got out of it. The idea of enhanced callable capital is, can we solve some of the real problems that callable capital has? One way is to make the disbursement of it more automatic. So, for example, you create certain triggers within the MDB that would automatically trigger its release, and that everybody would know in advance what these triggers were. So that would mean the governments and everybody else saw it as more of a sort of real probability that they could assess and know how far away it was. So that's making it more automatic according to triggers. Another possibility is having those triggers occur earlier in the potential distress of an MDB. So instead of it being the absolute last resort when they've used up all their liquidity, they've stopped more or less doing everything they can, and they're about to default, instead of that, having it come at a much earlier stage. You know, why not when the organisation was about to be downgraded to single A, for example? It's still very creditworthy, completely functioning bank, but obviously we want it to be highly rated, so give it some extra capital at that moment. And even more potentially useful idea is, well, why not give it when it's about to lose its AAA? And I believe the World Bank is definitely thinking about this option. All the MDBs that are AAA rated think it's incredibly important for them to stay AAA, and therefore why not protect that? Get the shareholders to agree to cough up some more money if that AAA is ever in doubt. So instruments like this could be ultimately beginning to appear. There's obviously a huge amount of work and negotiation And sort of difficult conversations that have to happen before that could happen.
And you say instruments, so how is this going to be done? Are we talking about sort of privately issued hybrid securities like the World Bank has done?
I think this would be a new form of callable capital. So it would have to be hardwired into the organisations, not necessarily their absolute founding documents, but it would have to be, you know, fully agreed by the board. In fact, everything they do, including hybrid capital, has to be agreed by the board. But it would be a kind of proper international negotiation in which all the countries would have to think about it and decide whether they agreed to this. But nobody has the answer yet. This is very much early stage discussions. But I think it is an interesting way. An avenue, because it is addressing the thing that is most problematic about callable capital, or it's sort of acknowledging that the instrument has inherent problems.
Right, and I mean, speaking of the World Bank, it's revealed a couple more ways to power up its lending this week, hasn't it?
Yeah, so there's also exciting things happening at the World Bank, which are very much real and have happened. These were announced last Friday. The context for all this is the spring meetings of the IMF and World Bank, which have been going on in Washington. And the World Bank has got two major announcements of interest to capital markets people. One of them is hybrid capital. Now, they agreed with Germany in September last year that Germany would invest 305 million euros in a private issue of hybrid capital. Now, that would be the first hybrid issue by the World Bank. Since then, the African Development Bank has, of course, issued a successful public deal with commercial investors. That was in January, $750 million. The World Bank hasn't done that yet. It's got a plan to work on a public issue of hybrids, but that will be some way off. But what it has done now is get a whole bunch of countries, I think there's seven in all, to agree to invest in these private issues of hybrid capital. So the UK, Denmark, Latvia, Norway, the Netherlands, alongside Germany, and that will mean they're basically providing capital to the World Bank, which is treated as 100% equity by the World Bank itself and by all three rating agencies. That means they can leverage it up just as if it was paid in capital, but it's constitutionally much easier. It doesn't give those countries extra voting rights. It doesn't change, you know, the fundamental arrangements of the World Bank's capital structure. It's easier to do.
And it's also come up with something called a portfolio guarantee platform. Tell us about that, because that's worth $10.5 billion. That's not insignificant, is it?
Yeah. So, in a way, this is even more exciting because it's newer, and it's potentially very powerful. The idea is that countries can contribute guarantees, and through this platform, the portfolio guarantee platform, they have agreed to guarantee any losses on the World Bank's balance sheet up to the total amount that they've agreed, which so far is $10.5 billion. Now, the US is putting in $9 billion, Japan $1 billion, and the rest is coming from France and Belgium. So those four countries together are the lead contributors to this guarantee platform. What's so powerful about it is it's, first of all, timely payment of principal and interest is guaranteed. So they're saying that basically, if any country defaults or stops paying interest on its loan to the World Bank, these countries will make it good, you know, and they'll keep paying that loan until, you know, it's fully paid, if they have to. Now, the second thing is it applies right across the board. So this guarantee sort of hunts out loss, if you think about it, anywhere it occurs. It's not just covering a slice of the balance sheet. It's everything. And that's immensely useful. So the World Bank has done modelling, and they reckon this will enable them to do extra lending to the value of six times the size of the guarantee programme. And because it's quite large, that means $63 billion of extra lending commitments the World Bank can make over 10 years. So it's about $6 billion a year.
And I think you've worked out that that's basically a 30% increase in capacity over the 10 years.
Well, if you take together the hybrid capital, the portfolio guarantee platform, and another change that they made last year, which was to allow their equity to loan ratio to fall to a minimum of 19%. Take all those things together, you get $120 billion of extra lending over 10 years, which is, I, according to my estimate, 30% more than they were doing last year.
And of course, the thing with the MDBs, they are all different. They're all set up differently. Their constitutions are different. The way they are given capital is different. But of course, the World Bank is the sort of leading institution in the sector, and what it does, other MDBs tend to follow. So this must be quite an exciting development for the sector. Do you think we could see more sort of portfolio guarantee schemes at other MDBs, for example?
This is a very interesting question. It's true that the World Bank is the lead organisation in the sector, but it's not always the one that goes first with things. You know, some of the innovations have come from the African MDBs, including the African Development Bank. However, in this particular case, yes. What I think we can safely say is that structurally, this would work for any MDB. What we don't know is whether the shareholders would have appetite to finance it. You know, and it's entirely down to the US, Japan, Belgium and France being willing to take that risk. Now, it's anyone's guess whether they would do that for other MDBs, right? But if shareholders were willing to do this, it would work for any of them. It's quite advantageous for the guarantor countries in a way, because they don't have to put the money up front. You know, so they don't have to borrow money in the bond market and contribute it to the World Bank. That's the same with callable capital. They get that advantage from that as well. But on the other hand, it does mean they're signing up to absorb any loss the World Bank gets over the next 20 years until that $10.5 billion is exhausted. And that's quite a brave thing to do.
Yeah, well, John, you've written in great depth about this again this week, far more material than we can possibly discuss in the podcast. So I really would urge anyone interested in this sector or in this development to go to globalcapital.com, take out a trial access, or, you know, better still, just subscribe. And you can read John's work there. I mean, he spoke to some very senior people in the World Bank about this and about their thoughts on hybrid capital and the ins and outs of it. So, I don't think you'll find any reporting anywhere as in-depth on this topic as this. But in the meantime, we spoke to Craig Coburn, our new columnist, about what he'll be covering and about the perils of being stuffed with duff mandates in a rising market. But first, a word from our sponsor. This podcast is proud to be sponsored by KfW. KfW wants to become the digital transformation and promotional bank of Germany by 2030. Thus, KfW aims at accelerating the sustainable transformation and strengthening Germany as an industrial and technology location. In doing so, KfW is focusing its activities on the action areas of climate and environment, digitalization and innovation, managing impact and mobilizing private capital, and a top-performing KfW. To fund its promotional activities, KfW issues bonds on the international capital markets. With an issuance volume of 90 billion euros in 2023 and a targeted volume of 90 to 95 billion euros in 2024, KfW is one of the world's largest and most active issuers of bonds. Efficient processes and a high degree of automation in the issuance of securities are thus of strategic interest to KfW. And I'm delighted to be joined by KfW's treasurer, Tim Ambruster, and Gaetano Pano, its head of transaction management. Tim, in the last 18 months, KfW has successfully implemented various digitalization initiatives at KfW Treasury. What's the rationale behind it?
Yeah, first of all, thanks for the opportunity, Ralph. And as you have mentioned in your introduction, KfW is one of the world's largest and most active SSA market participants in segments like on the money market side, the capital market side, and also on the derivative side. If we take, for example, in the cross-currency swap space. So if you put it together, we have a natural interest in the further development of the respective market segments. Our focus is here on the process efficiency, so in the end, to minimize operation risk. So one of the key topics is, for example, STP, straight pass-through. Key is for us, of course, in the end, the scalability of the product. But also, what I think personally is very important is the aspect of learning, especially with regards to new technology like the DLT, so the distributed ledger technology. And new digital developments are emerging on the international financial markets. We see that. And it is for KfW, it is for us important to understand what are the benefits they can bring to us and how we can make them really tangible.
What kind of innovations have you already implemented? Can you give some examples?
Yeah, since end of 2022, we have been actively pushing numbers of digitalizations and innovation trends. You can say we have a multi-track approach, testing of different digitalization and innovation trends in our derivative and also in our issuance activities, each one starting at a different point and providing solutions for different topics. And I can give you a few examples which we have successfully implemented in parts of innovations, parts due to minimal viable products. For example, on the derivative side, so on the OTC side, we call it the transport currency method from LCH for cross-currency swaps activities. The idea behind is to use euro collateral currency and at the time to achieve valuations analogous to collateralization with US dollar. And there we have done the first transaction in March 2023. We're also active on the money market side with the trading platform of Onbrane. The key target is here to improve the communication and reduce operational complexity when issuing our CPs. There we have done the first transaction in April 2023. We have now in total over 3 dealers onboarded. And when we see this development, we also plan a comparable solution for the capital market activities. This is something we hope we can announce the first deal very shortly. And on the capital market side, we did our first issuance of a digital bond on the D7 platform of Deutsche Börse on the basis of the German Electronic Security Act. And the German Security Act has two legs, and one of the legs opens up for the dematerialization of a debt certificate. And our primary focus here was clearly the learning experience and testing of new solutions. Yeah? For us, the next logical step is now also to use the second leg of the German Electronic Securities Act. This is essential for Paris to issue a crypto debt security. And these are usually issued and based on DLT, so the distributed ledger technology. As I have communicated at the end of last year, we intend to issue such a bond in 2024. But very important is, as also Gaetano sits next to me, beside the financial market department, the transaction management department of KfW plays here also a crucial role in the overall process. And that is why we are work very closely together with Gaetano's team. They are in charge of processing the transaction, but also for establishing the, you can say, the IT technical basis for it.
Gaetano, what's special about the issuance of a blockchain-based digital bond? Can you tell us a bit more about the processes that take place in the background? And what are the main challenges that you're facing in the preparation of such a transaction?
Of course, Raj. Thanks for that question. First of all, it's important to mention that KfW is subject to certain provision of German and European bank regulatory law. And as such, it is provided by the BaFin and the German Federal Ministry of Finance, and thus needs to fulfill certain requirements. From the very beginning, we considered this MVP as a learning journey to understand occurring challenges during the life cycle of a crypto debt security. And on the one hand, we invited external partners to work out the requirements of the market. And on the other hand, we involved colleagues from the different departments within KfW for an end-to-end view and an overall risk assessment. Using the distributed ledger technology for this, for the issuance of our bond opens opportunities, but also bears new sorts of risk. So one of our main challenges has been to design a process covering the whole life cycle that is also considering arising risks. And these types of risk range from cybersecurity to service provider risks. So we took the steps to design a product that leverages new technology as well as the German Electronic Securities Act, is attractive to the market, and last but not least, meets high security standards.
And Tim, assuming you've successfully conducted the issuance of your first blockchain-based digital bond until the end of the year, what will be the next steps? And what role will these kinds of transactions play in your future issuance program?
Yeah, I think if you want to sum it up, the long-term goal, and you can say this is for all our digitalization initiatives, is of course the development of scalability, so of scalable products, you can say. And long-time internal discussion was in KfW to see what we have today. So if you look at today, KfW issuances are characterized by a first-class rating, so the AAA rating. And of course, a high secondary market liquidity. And these, of course, features which are investor value very high. And any new product must also have these important characteristics for the investors, because otherwise it doesn't make sense for us to change our running system. And we thus need to transfer these specifications, of course, to potential new products, especially secondary market liquidity, so the possibility of secondary market liquidity. So in our digitalization activities, we thus want to encourage other market participants, investors, banks, to join also our initiatives, to learn with us together, especially in order to professionally develop this market. And you need, of course, for developing market, also the infrastructure. And I think this is probably a first good test case. Everybody who wants to test it. Yeah. To sum it up, if you want to have a say, you have to know what you're talking about. And I think learning is very important on this journey. And we have to try things out and to learn, even especially when the market is not yet fully developed.
Tim, Gaetano, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you, Ralph.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Hello, Craig. Welcome to the Global Capital Podcast.
Hello. Good afternoon or good morning.
Now, we're very excited to have you on board as our new columnist. Many will be familiar with your witty and engaging writing style, but also your real grasp of how capital markets really work. But for those of our listeners who are unfamiliar with you, can you tell us a little bit about your background and how you've come to be such a good candidate for a capital markets columnist?
Well, I spent 25 years in investment banking, running European and later global equity capital markets at Bank of America, Merrill Lynch. I spent some time in Asia as well. And so I think I've had a pretty long history in the capital markets, more so on the equity side, but also a little bit on the debt side. And since taking career retirement about 2 years ago, I've been pursuing a variety of different independent projects. And I had been approached by a couple publications about writing for them, and it just developed into a passionate side hobby.
Craig, you're based in London, aren't you? And quite a lot of your career has been in the European market.
That is correct. So I moved to London in 1995, notwithstanding my dulcet New Jersey tones. I was a lawyer at the time. But in early 1997, I moved to Deutsche Bank to work in the equity capital markets department. I spent eight and a half years there. And then in middle of 2005, I moved over to Merrill Lynch, which, as you know, was acquired by Bank of America during the financial crisis.
Okay, so what are you planning to write for us, Craig? There's two. You're actually going to do two columns, aren't you? In the finest global capital tradition of never letting someone just do one job, we've given you two. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what you'll be writing?
Well, I think we have two column ideas. One is going to be sort of a kind of inside the beltway equivalent but for financial professionals, sort of talking about, you know, life as a banker, almost like my secret diaries. Some of the nuances that professionals might appreciate that are probably hiding in plain sight, if you will, for the general public. Talking about what life is like in a bank, talking about what life is like as a banker through the good times and the bad times. You know, some of the issues that seem to perennially arise for people, and how banks and how bankers and financiers deal with them. The other column is going to be a kind of agony ant column. It's a proven formula, but it hasn't been applied yet. It hasn't been applied before for financiers or bankers. But I think a lot of people in the city, Wall Street, you know, they struggle in their careers and they don't have anybody to ask questions to, because anybody they ask a question to, it suddenly can become a very complex or sensitive or political issue. Mm-hmm. And so my objective is to give independent advice, career advice, anonymously, pseudonymously, to people who write in.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. I remember in my very junior days as a very junior banker years and years ago, an absolute sort of sense of paranoia about who I could possibly approach about career advice, because I always felt that ask one wrong question to the wrong person and you were basically finished, because you would come across as either disloyal or undedicated or some other horror. And I've certainly not, you know, and certainly I think in capital markets you get a lot of sort of bravado as well, and people will often tell you something with great confidence that they don't, well, you know, maybe that confidence isn't quite so well placed. So I hope this will be extremely valuable to our readers.
I mean, that's interesting. I think imposter syndrome applies very much to people who work in finance, as well as a lot of other top professions such as law or consulting. And so it becomes very difficult for people to be open, even with their colleagues, even with their friends at work. And not only that, the city and Wall Street are going through a number of changes, wrenching changes. They're coming out from a real trough in activity. So has Hong Kong. I mean, Hong Kong is still in the doldrums. And that creates its own set of challenges for people working in the industry. There's less money to go around. There are fewer jobs to go around to keep everyone happy. And how do you manage those challenges? What do you say? What don't you say? What happens if you have a colleague or a boss that's creating problems for you? And I think it's actually very difficult to know where to turn. So I hope we'll get a good response with this column.
Craig, did you ever have an experience like that where, you know, you wished you'd had an agony aunt or uncle to turn to?
Oh, yes. I mean, I had many challenges and setbacks in my career. And, you know, I was fortunate in many cases to have some really good friends I could talk to. But it varied from time to time. You have no one to talk to, or no one useful you could talk to, no one with the kind of experience and seniority that you need to take a dispassionate view of the situation. And it's very hard to talk about it even with your friends, because a lot of the nuance gets lost for people who are muggles, for normal people. Whereas if you've worked in the industry, you tend to see some of the same patterns over and over again.
Yeah, it's own sort of a rarefied atmosphere, I think, compared to a lot of other careers. And I wonder too if this might end up being something that you know, non capital markets people will end up having an interest in reading, just for an insight into the into the industry themselves. Sort of, I don't know, almost like a sort of modern day liar's poker. I mean, this column is going to be called New
Modern
Issues.
Day Ann Landers.
Ann Landers, who's
yes,
that?
You know, you don't know who Ann Landers is. She's the most famous advice columnist ever in the United States.
Oh, I only know Dear Deirdre in The Sun, I'm afraid.
Oh, yeah, she's a legend, but that's an American reference. So
right.
Over your head.
Fair enough.
You'll have to Google her afterwards.
I will, and I'll send you a couple of examples of Dear Deirdre's photo casebook in case you're unfamiliar with her oeuvre. Okay, so we're calling that column New Issues. Your other column is going to be called Coben the Contrarian. We published the first of those today. Tell us a little bit about what it's about.
Look, activity is coming back, and that seems to be good news. I mean, it's coming back in fits and starts for people in the financial sector. But it's not unvarnished good news, especially for people in sort of second and third tier franchises where, you know, their league table position may have been flattered in a down market. And it creates its own set of issues. Bear in mind, you know, your performance is judged on an absolute basis as well as on a relative basis. And, you know, you run the risk of lagging on a relative basis, which creates all sorts of challenges and issues for you in the workplace. And so I was trying, I think that kind of gets lost sometimes. I mean, we are in a cyclical rebound. We can discuss how strong, how sustainable, how broad, but activity is rebounding, but that's not undiluted good news.
Mm. It's a bit of a paradoxical idea and a surprising one. And you highlight particularly the fact that, as you put it, you know, second tier or third tier firms, might their league table position might have been flattered in a downturn. So why is that?
Well, a lot of those firms are universal banks, and so they could put out a balance sheet to effectively buy business or buy their position, their senior position in a deal. You know, capital is coveted during a downturn, much less so when capital is widely available. And in addition, you don't have to, you only need to win maybe a couple of deals or gain a couple of mandates in order to have a pretty strong league table position. When you have a lot of transactions, then the league tables are more representative of your relative positioning. And it becomes harder to game the league tables by using your balance sheet.
Do you think then that that attempt to use balance sheet in a downturn is sort of ultimately futile, or is it worth it for the short term?
Great question. Hard to answer in a general. Look, I think every bank, even the top tier banks, have to use balance sheet. I mean, balance sheet is, unless you're a boutique, balance sheet is a requirement for certainly the bigger banks. Even if they don't have a deposit franchise. But, you know, it really depends a little bit on what area of business you're talking about. Certainly, you know, in the strategic businesses like M&A, equity capital markets, leverage finance, the larger banks will need a balance sheet, and they will be expected to put forward the balance sheet, whereas a boutique can probably get away with just providing advice, but it's never going to be really vying for the top spots in the league tables.
Just for our non-bank listeners, what specifically do we mean here by balance sheet? Are we talking just about lending or about underwriting or both or subsidizing?
I mean it in the broadest sense of the word, actually. So it can be providing credit. It can be committing capital to underwrite an issue or to trade an issue. It's quite broadly defined. So it's really across the whole gamut. You know, bear in mind, banks now have to be quite tactical in how they use balance sheet. It's very painful from a capital management standpoint to warehouse risk. So even if you're putting balance sheet out there, you know, certainly on an underwriting basis, you don't want to be a storage unit. You want to be buying and selling. You want to be in the moving business, not in the storage business. But when it comes to provision of capital from a lending perspective, there again, you have a lot of subtleties because most financial institutions look for funded loans, so loans where you actually disperse and you're lending for a purpose. But a lot of clients, especially big corporate clients, demand revolving credit facilities where, you know, they can, which they can draw on when they need the capital. That tends to be low margin, very capital consumptive, and not terribly attractive for financial institutions to provide.
But this pattern you're talking about with especially, you know, commercial banks or second tier investment banks, perhaps, being able to sort of outperform in a downturn and having to pull their socks up or having a tougher time in an upturn, and that being related to how they use balance sheet, is that something that's always been the case, would you say, or has that evolved over time, and did it used to be different?
I actually think it's a generalization, and first of all, it's a generalization, and there are many exceptions. Second, I do think it has been a pattern, certainly over the last couple of decades, that in a downturn, the top banks either lose their top position or their lead over the other banks is smaller, just because there are fewer transactions and the clients are prepared to retain banks for the sake of balance sheet, whether it's providing credit or providing an underwriting, in a way that maybe wouldn't be the case when capital is more plentiful and deals are easier to execute.
And it also implies probably that the what one could call the top banks or the sort of, you know, most proficient investment banks are also feel more confident to withhold capital when times are tough, doesn't it?
Yes. What I would say, though, is that banks that are very focused on strategic business are always going to be very disciplined in how they allocate their capital. And in many cases, they can't afford to put it out sort of a little bit less, you know, indiscriminately to clients. So there tends to be a little bit more discipline. I also think there's a cultural element to this as well. In the U.S., I mean, you had Glass-Steagall until 1999. You had the separation of investment banking and commercial banking. In Europe, investment banking and commercial banking have always been intertwined in the form of sort of universal banks. And so, you know, that legacy remains very strong in Europe, whereas in the U.S. it's more mixed. Obviously, you do, even the traditional investment banks, the large ones, do lend. But still, you have, I think, a pedigree of trying to separate out strategic and advisory from capital provision.
One of the things you've also written about this week, Craig, is about how in a downturn, banks will take on, well, bankers have a need to look busy, to be seen to be busy, because, you know, they have to justify the costs of their bit of the business. And so they will take on in a downturn business that they might not normally agree to. And one of the key points in your column is that, well, how do you deal with those, what we might euphemistically call marginal mandates, when the market picks back up and you want to be doing the good business, but you're already committed to doing these other deals? How does that work in practice?
I mean, it's a real problem in a downturn. You need to look busy, you need to be busy, and you need to bring in anything you can, subject to applicable law and regulation. And so that means you'll bring in business that otherwise might not pass the test for being, you know, economic. So business that I call marginal. And you end up working on it, and they tend to take up a lot of time. Even smaller deals take up, in many cases, almost as much time as bigger deals. And then business picks up, and you need to be out there hustling for mandates that are quite attractive. And yet you've already committed yourself and committed resource to a mandate that's marginal, it's going nowhere, that nobody really wants to work on. And it's a real problem. I mean, some of the, you know, in my memories of going back 25 years, some of the biggest issues I've seen internally is when people are stuck on mandates that nobody really wants to work on, everybody wants to disengage from, but they can't because they have a moral obligation to this client that they'd work on it. And it's very hard to deal with. That's why I think it is important in a downturn to be still very disciplined about your business and client selection and not try to drag in whatever the cat, you know, not try to work on whatever the cat brought in, but really to maintain your high standards, even if it means you'll miss out on a couple smaller deals while other people are printing, because it's a bit of a fool's errand. But that's easy to say. It's not so easy to do in practice when, you know, business is slow. Everyone's worried if there's that there are going to be a headcount or there could be headcount reductions. It's easier said than done.
Mm. And ultimately, do these deals tend to get done, or do bankers suddenly forget to pick up the phone when the client calls? Or I mean, how does it work?
I mean, eventually. Eventually they probably, the deals will either die or get done. But it's just a question of how long it takes to disengage and how much glass is broken along the way. I can tell you, I was approached, just to give you an idea. So I've been doing some expert witness work, and we were approached by a client, by a company or an entrepreneur who had retained a bulge bracket bank for a mandate. And, you know, he felt, you know, they weren't working on it. They were dragging their feet. They weren't getting it done. And as he was explaining it to me, I could tell immediately this was not a good mandate. This was always going to struggle to get done. And I could understand why that bulge bracket bank wanted to get out of it. Now, I declined to work on the case for various reasons. But it's just a little indication of, you know, it's just an example. The client here couldn't understand why they weren't being responsive anymore, whereas I could understand straight away what was going on.
But in that example, I mean, there are lots of banks on the street, right? Equity capital markets is more concentrated in terms of the ones who do, you know, a large share of the business than debt capital markets. But nevertheless, there's a lot of banks that can do an IPO or whatever the deal was. And you'd think that it would be better for that entrepreneur to just ring up some other bank. But is there some reason why he felt it was such, you know, he'd gone so far with this bank that he needed to kind of almost take them to court?
Well, first of all, there's a lot of sunk costs. I mean, that bank may have done due diligence. You've started the work with that bank. You've run up legal and accounting costs with that bank. And bringing somebody new in will take up a lot of time and incur a lot of additional expense. I think, secondly, in the back of this person's mind, he was probably wondering if another bank would take it on because, you know, if you fire one bank, you know, if a client comes to me and says, I just fired my bank, will you work on it? Because they were no good, will you work on it? I always, my gut instinct is to think there are two sides to the story. Mm-hmm. And I may not take that on. I may think there's something, you know, there may be some unexploded ordinance here somewhere that I haven't seen. And so I may just hesitate and may drag my feet. I mean, if you're firing a perfectly good bank and you want to work with me, I don't know. Mm. There might be some, you know, there's a reason for that. And there, it's like I said, there are always two sides to the story. And so it's not that easy just to switch horses.
But Craig, when you were doing equity capital markets and I was writing about it, remember we talked quite often about the role of the advisors. The ECM advisors. So basically firms that specialize in advising companies on how to deal with their investment banks and how to pick the right one and how to handle a syndicate and so on. So isn't this something that an advisor ought to be able to sort out?
Well, not really, because the advisor, advisors are used on, let's say, you know, 40% of IPOs in Europe, smaller percentage in Asia, much smaller percentage in Asia, and a smaller percentage in the US. if you have an independent advisor like that, I mean, they help you with the selection of the bank, you know, everything seems to be great. But then if the bank drags its feet, I mean, there's not much that the advisor can really do about it. The problems of changing horses remains the same. And, you know, if a reputable bank is demurring on a mandate, if they're trying to pull out of a mandate, that's probably indicative. I mean, the bankers, you know, that I competed against were generally speaking very smart and sensible people. And there's usually a reason why. And that means it is probably, for whatever reason, an unattractive mandate. It's a time sink, whatever you want to call it.
Mm.
And, you know, by the way, you find this sometimes or more commonly in emerging markets transactions, where, you know, it's a bit marginal. It's not that easy to get done in the first place, even in a good market. And then it just becomes progressively harder and harder. I'm not saying it's exclusive to emerging markets, but it tends to happen there more commonly. You have a local banker who really wants to show that he or she has mandates. He kind of convinces the product people or the London people to come over and pitch and get this mandate. And then, it turns out the mandate is actually very difficult to execute. The local banker is still clamoring for attention and resource, and everybody else wants to be somewhere else.
And would it typically be the case? I mean, normally on an IPO, for example, there's more than one bank, right? I know sometimes that there aren't, but you'd usually get a couple or three. And is it normally the case that if one bank is dragging its feet, the others will be as well?
Or sometimes yes, sometimes no. I've seen both patterns. Mm. It really varies, but I think the broader point is it's not so much getting out from underneath it, but the broader point is about client selection. That if you're not disciplined in a downturn on client selection and business selection, then it's going to come back and bite you when the rebound happens. But the temptation in a downturn is to take on everything, because even a small fee keeps the lights on.
Mm.
And that's the real tension. It's not, you know, if someone's in a deal and they have to get out, whatever. I mean, people, you know, you do have the right to resign from mandates, just as a client has a right to fire you. So that's neither here nor there. The real issue for me, you know, the real issue I think for banks is going to be, you know, have you been disciplined in how you allocated your resource during the downturn so that you can take advantage when the upturn happens? And there's two ways that you find yourself shorthanded. One way is you're wasting your time you're pinned down on mandates that don't work. And the other is that is if you cut headcount too much, and then you're suddenly short-staffed.
Mm.
And those are the two worries. Those are the two dangers that you have.
All right, Craig. Well, thank you. That column you've written is called "The Market Rebound That Could Smack You in the Face." It's incredibly entertaining, as was this discussion. And I should say, moreover, very insightful. And we look forward to reading what else you have to publish with us in the future. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, guys. And I look forward to talking again and to writing some more. I love writing.